Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. And believe it or not, we're going to talk about something today connected to both Orthodoxy and Nationalism. The name of this show, of course, refers to the show itself, not me. It's not a moniker. It's the name of the show. And somehow people think that's what I call myself. Of course I am one, but I never would call myself that, you know. Today we're going to do something that, this is by request and something that I should have done some time ago. Many years ago, I did a show on Dmitri Ljotić, the Serbian National Socialist, and his ideology. And today I'm going to do someone who actually has more immediate relevance, and that is Milan Nedic, who was the prime minister of the Government of National Salvation. Now, we talked about Patriarch Gabriel on this show just a few weeks ago. We talked about the political conditions of Yugoslavia. And how significant Germany was. Remember, when you're talking about the Great Depression, a few things are happening in Europe. Liberal democracies have failed everywhere. Bankers and industrialists control everything, and these, you know, symbolic parties argue over trifles. It failed in Greece, in Spain, in Germany. And people start realizing the unfortunate fact that politicians are window dressing. Now, they always have been. But in a post-royal world, which is the post-World War I era. Now, the banking oligarchy, as well as their industrial subordinates, connected with military forces, and of course their colonizing entities, rule openly. Now, of course, they rule, I shouldn't say openly, they rule far more blatantly than it did before. A monarch can always, and did many times, go over the heads of finance capital to fix the problem. Russia would never give its currency over to the bankers. A mark of sovereignty, one of the great marks of sovereignty, is in fact coining your own money and having that money connected with your own economic policy. An independent central bank is not independent. It's like independent media. It's propaganda. It just means under the control of oligarchs. In Russia's case, you know, she had extraordinary economic growth with firm royal control over the currency. And her exposure to the money markets wasn't substantial compared with other countries. But World War I was partially about destroying the mentality of sovereignty and bringing everything under a banking oligarchy, bringing everything within the exposure of so-called market forces in currency and finance. The more exposure you have, the less independence you have. And we're talking about a handful of families here. Well, Germany, having lost the Kaiser, who had been a very strong and worthwhile ruler, went, as you all know, in the Weimar Republic to almost nothing. Her currency was worthless. Her economy had collapsed. Her industry had been dismantled and sent to England or France. She had just lost millions of her best men. There was absolutely no morale, no trust in public institutions. No one cared about the Weimar state. It didn't have any real sacredness. It was simply just an administration. Healthcare had collapsed. Germany was attacked in the world press. Everything was their fault, even though that was a blatant lie. The Soviet Union, of course, was growing to the east. And as we've talked about on this show, the Jewish Marxist movements, and we can call them really ethnic movements, in Hungary and then in the German case, Bavaria and Saxony, were growing substantially. In fact, in Bavaria, there was a brief Jewish ethnic enclave that called itself the People's Republic of Bavaria in close union with the USSR. So then you have a politician who is elected, a patriot who is elected. What is he going to do? What would you do under those circumstances? What would you do if you're elected to a situation where there is no worthwhile currency, there is no economy, you have no military force to speak of, the police are overwhelmed, that there is no morale, there's no public health care, no trust in institutions. What do you do? Well, there's only one thing to do, and you do what Hitler did. Now, I say this because Yugoslavia had the good fortune of connecting itself to Germany in this period of time. By far, Germany was Yugoslavia's number one trading partner. As you all know, Operation Punishment was launched in 1941, unfortunately, as a result of the British-engineered Stepanovich coup of the Air Force that overthrown the pro-Axis government and installed a puppet pro-Allied government, even though it was very clear, as we've talked about this at length, that the treaty that Hitler offered was far better than what the Allies offered. Which meant that, of course, Germany was delayed in its invasion of the Soviet Union. This also, incidentally, is why the Germans were never big fans of the NDH. The Ustasha in Croatia was largely an Italian and to a lesser extent Hungarian phenomenon. The German high command, and I could send you citations, said these people are fanatics. We don't know what to do with them. And they're causing a lot of trouble. Hitler offered, the monarchy protection against them. I think we can't exaggerate the extent to which Hitler and Mussolini really were close. I think Hitler didn't take Mussolini very seriously, not even in North Africa. I think he treated Mussolini in the same respect that he treated Franco. Or, in our case today, General Nedich. Now, the concept of collaboration is really this arrogant, Judeo-centric concept that says you should, for the sake of saving a few Jews, turn your country over to the Stalinists rather than cooperate with the German authorities. That's essentially what they say. That the only thing that you guys should be concerned about is the fate of the Jews that live within your borders. The collaborationist accusations made in Ukraine with Bandera and it's made in Yugoslavia, or the new Serbian entity under Nedic in former Yugoslavia, after 1941. Now, there are all kinds of collaboration. There is this enthusiastic, we're of one mind, and then there is, we have no other choice. Very different kinds of collaboration. But the Jewish mind is so arrogant that upon the invasion of your country from Germany, which had not been a hostile power up until that point, your major concern should not be this massive communist empire to your east. No, the handful of Jews that live in a few cities. German collaboration, support of the Germans made sense ethically and politically, especially if it meant that Serbs were going to be protected from the NDH, which is something that Hitler promised long before Operation Punishment came into existence. Milan Nedic is a general in the Royal Service. He was extremely popular. He was one of these guys who kept a low profile but was considered a very high quality. He was a line officer, so to speak. And his loyalty was to Serbia primarily. A distant second was Yugoslavia. Then, of course, Germany as a distant third. He didn't appreciate the invasion of his country. He did not collaborate in the sense that he thought this was a great idea. He did believe in the coup, which is something negative you could say about him. Now, of course, we have hindsight. It's not fair to judge him. But the 1941 coup that overthrew Prince Paul, it was known. I mean, the British knew that this was going to create a German invasion. They knew this was going to create chaos in the country, but if it took some pressure off Great Britain, then it was good. But that was a very irrational position to hold. Hitler was doing absolutely nothing wrong. He was doing everything right. The man, especially in this period of time, in the 30s, and very early 40s, was a genius. Taking a destroyed, broken country and creating this immense empire in a few years. I mean, I've spoken about it on this show with people like, you know, Chung Hee Park in Korea or Putin in Russia, you know, rebuilding the ruins of an old society. And that's very, there are very few men you could say that about. But Hitler did it faster than both of them. And so, of course, attaching your economy to the German National Socialist system was by far the most rational thing to do. In Eastern Europe, it was fully known what Stalin was and what he was doing. The Western world was enamored with the Soviet Union. Especially in the pre-war era, it was enamored with communism and Bolshevism. It was supported by Western bankers and industrialists. And as you well know, listeners to this show know that the Soviet Union was built and created by Western capital. The Soviets had lost so many people in World War I and their own civil war. Their engineers and intellectuals were not in plentiful supply in 1918. So how in heaven's name did they have this first world industrial economy in a couple of years? In less than a generation? Well, of course, it came from Western investment. I was reading, and this is something, I know this is an aside, but I was reading about the American reaction to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And the White House, under President Carter, issued a statement saying there is now sanctions placed on the USSR. All high-tech transfers have been canceled. All trade for them has been eliminated, and all grain supplies have been stopped. Now, what surprises me is that no one finds that remarkable. I thought there was a Cold War. High-tech transfers? They're being stopped? How come there weren't sanctions on the Soviet Union before? I thought they were our arch enemies. Grain supplies? Russia under the Tsars was feeding the planet? The U.S. is now feeding Russia? I thought we were enemies. Do you normally trade and support and buttress your opponents? This has come up actually quite a bit. I mean, there's simply no way that a Western government and liberal democracy can tell a huge corporation what to do. They'll trade with, and they did trade with the Soviet Union anyway. Like German companies today are trading with Russia and Belarus despite the sanctions. The price that a government would have to pay bringing these companies to court, they're looking forward to years of litigation. The company would probably win. They have far more lawyers than the government does and far more resources. And the worst part is that a lot of dirty laundry, the government's legislative apparatus is going to be aired in any public court proceeding. So in other words, they could do as they please. And Boeing and the military-industrial complex traded with the USSR after Carter as it did before. You only have sanctions on Russia when the nationalists take over. Anyway, the connection of Yugoslavia, Belgrade, and Berlin was such that the Yugoslav economy was growing very, very rapidly. And there was uneven growth. You know, Slovenia was growing faster, and the Yugoslav model permitted, you know, one side to subsidize another. And so someone was being, you know, punished for being too successful. And this has been always a complaint. You know, Serbia had to support, you know, Bosnia. Slovenia had to support pretty much everyone because the wealthier areas were called on to support the others. But the fact is that when Hitler invaded, not a whole lot of people were really upset that the Yugoslav idea had been destroyed. The Croats were never really a part of it. They were constant. And you remember that the Yugoslav idea came after World War I as a way to keep both Hungarian and Italian imperialists at bay. The countries there are too small on their own. The NDH, the Nationalists in Vojvodina, all this stuff, these are from Hungary, or the NDH, especially Italy. So these are definitely foreign powers that irritated Hitler. And Milan Nedic was not at the time seen as a collaborator. But again, even if he was, what difference does it make? He did the right thing. There are few Jews in Yugoslavia. And so he did not accept Operation Punishment, but he did accept the reality that Germany now controlled the country. And so he had to put together a concept as to how this country is going to be run. He was asked by the head of the German Air Force, the regional commander, to become prime minister of Serbia. And he said no. He said no several times. He said, I'm not the guy for this. I'm not really even all that pro-German here. And they begged him to do it because he had a good reputation. So on the 29th of August, 1941, he created the Government of National Salvation. And the one thing the Germans and the military had in common was their loathing of the Soviet Union. Now you had essentially a Serbia now independent of the NDH under indirect German control, although they used Bulgarian troops at some point to maintain order. But the point of Nedic's government was to create some rational administration. Now, there's a revisionist movement in Serbia these days. There's people like Milan Radunovic, who was saying that this man needs to be rehabilitated. There is an icon, actually, of his, a very beautiful one. He was a strict Orthodox man. He was murdered, no doubt. But that's fallen on deaf ears, and this is another aside, is that the educational system in the Balkans is controlled by the NGOs. NGOs, of course, you know, the National Institutes of Peace and all this stuff, George Soros, the major banks, the major oil firms. This is their corporate philanthropy. And they've focused on one freak of nature, Sabrina Ramit, or Rame, from Great Britain, who is the star researcher on Yugoslavia, and her entire, she's a transsexual freak, and she allegedly is the expert on Yugoslavia, and she has a bunch of these books, and this is the lead Sorosian scholar on these matters, and she actually sets the tone for how American academics and journalists look at Yugoslavia. She, like so many of these elite academics, has no real functional knowledge. She just takes advantage of the few, I mean, she doesn't really teach, but she has graduate assistants and students do papers. And of course, that's all nothing but free research that she uses, and then she tries to put it together in some kind of rational order. And that's a paper. The only concept is, of course, it has to be fully in support of the NATO alliance and global liberalism. I'm still having trouble getting people to understand that the American military, of course, they're the bad guys, that they are imposing liberalism and leftism throughout the world. That is their job. They are at war with traditionalist, nationalist, national socialist governments wherever they go. It was one thing when the Soviet Union still existed, and even then it was iffy. You know, there was no real war between the U.S. and the USSR, but when the USSR got too big, any country is going to be upset about that, regardless of ideology. When you read Sabrina's work, it's really just the pseudo-intellectualism, the overuse of academic jargon, over-citation, no real new information, but always the precise and exact ideological formulation of NATO and The Hague and the European Union. And she is the main force intellectually against Serbian nationalism and is, you know, the star researcher. And it's really hard if you don't have NGO support to really matter there. Education there is controlled by foreign banks and corporations. And they're the ones who have the grant money, and they create the institutes and all this other stuff. So she is obviously mentally ill, but also really ignorant. And it's just an ideologue for the system, which she's more than happy to serve for her six-figure salary. Anyway, just a few weeks ago, maybe a couple of months ago, we dealt with Patriarch Gabriel of Serbia. And so we dealt with the background of Yugoslavia and Germany at the time of the invasion and the problems that the German occupying force had. It was an extremely difficult country to control. Most of you are aware that, depending on the time period, the German infantry had stated that for every German that is killed by partisan forces or any anti-German rebel force, we will kill 100 locals. Sometimes it was 50. Now, this is where you have a problem. Milan Nedic said, okay, I'm going to take power, and I'm taking power just so I make sure that German soldiers don't get killed. We can't have them killed. And again, the people who would condemn him for collaboration say, oh no, they should have been wiped out for the sake of saving a few Jews. You know, they shouldn't have bothered you. You should have still fought the Germans, even though it may have meant the slaughter of the Serbian population. General Milan Nedic referred to the Anglo-Soviet alliance, as I have many times. This is prior to World War II, during and after. The Anglo-Soviet alliance showed that really you have two sides of one coin. You have liberal democracy, which essentially is oligarchy, and then state socialism, which has nothing to do with socialism, really. It's simply another oligarchy. You have elite groups of people who control the economy. Both groups are very similar ideologically. Neither group has a right to be there. And so the two systems are ultimately very similar. And national socialism and this sort of national corporatism, as Nedic and Ljotic tried to put forward, trying to put the best face possible on the German occupation, is something that really was more of a fait accompli. It was something that they had no choice but to do, especially given what we know now, the Soviet Union had every intention of invading Central Europe, which is why Hitler invaded in the first place. Well, the problem with getting any English language scholarly stuff out of the Balkans today is that it is controlled by Western corporations. The German army faced minimal resistance. Now, Yugoslavia is a big country. It faced almost no resistance. It collapsed instantaneously. And this is something that General Nedic noticed, saying that, you know, maybe the collapse here wasn't the greatest loss in the world. Serbia now has to be rebuilt with the aim of creating this militant force against the Anglosphere on the one side and the USSR on the other. And they wanted to create a new, for example, a new Serbian educational system. The government took over the University of Belgrade. And this often gets people like Sabrina all upset because they actually said, you know, if you're going to be receiving government money and you're going to be educating the elite of this country, you're going to make certain that you serve the common good. You're not going to support the Soviet Union. You're not going to support policies that destroy nations and peoples. You'll have a certain degree of independence, but you better make sure that you serve the common good of this country. It's nothing, you know, university autonomy just means that the left controls it. And so Nedic made quite a big deal about installing new professors there. And they built what ultimately was a truthful understanding, especially in history, the connection of Orthodoxy, St. Sava, the family of Nemanja, to Serbian history. And that he in this movement now was a continuation of that, an updating of that. The synthesis of the church and nation was essential to him. He was a military man, but he also was very strict in his Orthodox observance. I want to note that Ruth Mitchell, who wrote in the Daily Mail after the war, May 7th, 1947, General Nedic was very popular. That he was a populist, that his primary concern was anti-communist, but he was also anti-German. That he had served the Royal Army against Germany right up until the moment where they asked him to take over this government. So they certainly couldn't have asked him to take over based on any loyalty, because he had proven that wasn't the case. So the British made very clear that everyone knew that. And there's some false dichotomies here that you know, this article and others have to are dispelling. It's often said that during the German occupation, you had the Chetnik forces, or the centralized bands of warriors, most famously under Drahab Mihailović, somehow in opposition to Nedic. That is not true. The new work that has come out has proven close connections between Mihailović's forces and General Nedic. That Nedic was not supposed to be doing this, but he made certain that weaponry and money got to the Chetnik forces in the mountains. This for a long time was a bone of contention. You had a lot of anti-German thinking in Serbia because of the World War II experience. The policy of killing 100 locals or 100 Serbs for every German killed, I think 100 for every German killed and 50 for every wounded, made certain that someone like Nedish had to take over. But members of his government made it also clear that the partisan communists were deliberately killing Germans for the sake of wiping out the Serbs. The British said, "We're going to keep on fighting, we'll get supplies to you, and we really don't care what happens." The Great Britain was going to fight the very last drop of Serbian blood. Just like they did Russian blood in World War I. You know, with allies like this. You know. And so Great Britain simply didn't care about the policy. The partisan communists realized that, you know, this was wiping out entire villages, which is good by them. It saved them the trouble from having to do it. But it certainly wasn't something that Draslav Mihailović was doing. The Chetniks realized this, that there was far more unity there than had been previously thought. The U.S. and Great Britain were on the wrong side, because they were on the Soviet side. I fought Mihailović for supporting the Allies, and I've done in this show, and I've done it in the one on Patriarch Gabriel, that even the church hierarchy was wrong to place their bets on the Anglo-Soviet alliance. Now, even though Patriarch Gabriel and St. Nikolai Vemilovich were in Dachau for a while, Vemilovich had nothing but positive things to say about General Nedich and Ljotić, who, by the way, were, I believe, they were first cousins. So the connections between the Chetnik forces and Nedich were close. This was not a quisling government. This was not a puppet state by any means. But the literature simply refers to them because it's easy as that. Remember, when Hitler was defeated, it wasn't just Hitler and Hitlerism. It was nationalism as such. Because what Hitler's empire encouraged was the rise of all manner of ethno-national and religio-national entities. So the Orthodox nationalists under Kodrianu, for example, or the confessional nationalists under Nedich, the Greek Orthodox but very ethnic nationalists in Greece, the Catholic movement in Spain. Hitler, at some point, you know, left the Church of Rome and spoke of Christianity. He was very pro-Christian, of course. There's enough stuff in Mein Kampf to prove that. But in terms of the Church of Rome as such, you know, he referred to the confessions of Germany, meaning more than one. So he wasn't as pagan as some think, but this was just simply one element, one aspect of National Socialism. I mean, you had religious National Socialism. Leon de Grille, for example, is another manifestation of National Socialism that has religious entity and a religious basis. National Socialism combines both. I mean, Otto Strasser and Gregor Strasser have said this. It's well known that we want to take the love of labor from the left and the love of the nation from the right. That this is a winning combination. That this is a combination in connection with natural law. That if you're going to have socialism, if you're going to have the guild state, as Nedich called his government, or the proposals that he had, he only had a few years to do this. The guild state, it has to be based on something more than class. Class is a purely negative phenomenon. It's common in the literature. People like ignoramuses like Sabrina will talk about. They'll say that Nedich preached class cooperation and peace among classes, proving that this was just a capitalist drive to protect the wealth of the rich. Except she doesn't realize that the word class isn't used the same way as it is today. By classes, they meant functions. his government, although this was never really fully put into motion, had an upper house that was elected by the regional councils that represented commercial, legal, craft, medical, and industrial areas of vocation. And this comes straight out of Hegel and is essential to really all national corporatist thinking. That you have the lower house that is based on population. That's well known. You have it in the U.S. But in the upper house, you have more freedom. In the United States, it's based on, it was supposed to be based on the aristocracy. Not the titled aristocracy, but those who have, like the British House of Lords. You don't have to have a title. You get one when you get there, but this is not, you don't get elected because of it. You have to have distinguished yourself in some sense. And so state legislatures were supposed to elect, people to the Senate, and the populist movement in the 20s had eliminated that. And when you see people like Al Franken and these scum in the Senate, it's a mockery of the term. I mean, the Senate was an oligarchical institution in Rome, but they didn't have this. The worst, Dionysian mentality in Rome is far better than what we have today. Vladimir Yankovic was another ideologist working with Milan Nedic, talking about this synthesis of the craft guilds and the state. And the way to do it was to put it in the upper house. Population needed to be represented, especially because the essence of everything was the peasantry. This was the case. This is all of Serbian history. This is all of Ukrainian history. We cannot permit the destruction of the peasantry from industry or the state. They have to be the absolute center of the government. So population is extremely important. But craft industries, which are also very rural, are going to be represented in the upper house that's elected by provincial councils. And it makes sense if it was ever put into motion. His state, the guild state, the state of national reconstruction, was going to focus on, of course, rebuilding of infrastructure and the reorienting of the state from the Yugoslav idea to now one more focused on Germany. Or hopefully, one day, a free Russia. The second is to have a planned economy, not in the Soviet sense, but in the national sense, like you had in South Korea or in Japan after World War II, where you had production targets and the ability for the government to have the different classes and functions of society work together. The third thing was education and new technologies. This is for a rural population, that they were, of course, like all nationalist states, offered very cheap credit to the peasantry. But like you saw Alexander III in Russia, that's not enough. You have to also have something for them to spend their money on. And to help them simply get better. The crop yields were low in Serbia compared to Germany at the time. And technology was the reason. It had nothing to do with initiative or anything. It had to do with the different levels of technology. And in fact, Nedic had sent boys to study in Germany in the agricultural sciences. And finally, to end the class war altogether. Now, I've said, when I say class, I mean function. In America, when you say class, you mean rich versus poor. And it shows you the influence of Marxism in American life. The communists always attempt, and again, their influence is so overwhelming in American thought that very few people see, you know, National Socialism in all of its facets as anti-capitalist. But that's what it is. The word socialist is right in the name. And they try to figure out some way to say, well, this is just a scam. They don't worry about that, you know, GE built the electric grid of the Soviet Union. But they'll grab onto this and say, ah, you see, peace among classes. Well, if there's peace among classes, that means the wealthy will be safe with their millions. Since I've been studying the Balkans, which is my entire adult life, there's one concept that really stands out. And that is, once the Turkish Empire had been defeated, despite the best efforts of the British to prop them up, the group of people who came to rule over Serbia were foreigners. They had Serbian names and they spoke the language, but they had been educated in Great Britain and in Germany and sometimes Hungary, and they had a very different view of the world, and they really didn't have anything to say to the Serbian peasant anymore. These political parties, 19th century, progressive and conservative and all this, I spent a lot of time, you know, going over their platforms and everything else, and I'm sorry. No, these aren't really significant. These are groups of this new elite imported to the country. You see this in Africa too, after decolonization. These Western educated leaders who really had not much to do with the average peasant there and the tribal leaders. Ruling a country that they really didn't know. And it was taken for granted that anything that came out of the West was superior to anything that existed in Serbia, because they had been a subject people. Only a handful, Karadzic and a few others, had realized that, no, there's a native tradition here that we can unearth. One of the problems of having the under Turko-Hrvati and the completely non-canonical church that existed there, where Turkish law set a price for every metropolitan and every bishop and every abbot, to the point where these bishops weren't even bishops, they were just investors who never went to their diocese. These were investment groups at the Fanar. These weren't bishops at all. They destroyed much of the local histories. It was like Peter the Great and even the late reign of Alexis in Russia. Taking the old aristocratic families and their rank book, in English we call it rank books. These were real, these were multi-volume histories of the family and what they did and why they deserve to be at a place where they are. And burning those, Westerner says, oh, they're promoting meritocracy. This is great. Not realizing that they're destroying pages of history. The great enemy of the Turkish Fanar, fake church, it wasn't even a church, was, of course, ethno-nationalism. This is how the gospel has always been given to people. Through the medium of language and through the medium of customs in accordance with natural law. This has always been the case. But not here. This is why, as I've said many times, the Kolevadis fathers were so firmly involved in the ethnic principle, because they didn't see much of a difference between what is Greek and what is Orthodox. Because both were suppressed under Turko-Hrvati. So it was very easy for Greeks to bring in Enlightenment ideas from France, because in some cases they didn't even know what the patristic life was. This stuff had been destroyed. Under the Turks, there was no church life in the Balkans. How many bishops can you name in the Balkan area under the Turks? The only one I could name is St. Ambrose, who went to the old rite in Dolna Krunica. They're faceless entities. Patrick of Constantinople is one of the reasons that the Union movement did well. It was simply seen as a branch of Islam, a branch of the Turkish government. That this, whatever you want to call it, entity that was ruling over cathedrals and monasteries in the Balkans under the Turks, made sure that they destroyed the local histories so that then the Greeks can rule over these areas forever. And this is why I've condemned this whole philotism nonsense, and why the Russians did so as well, as did the Alexandrian Patriarch and everyone else who've been through this, and why the philotism stuff was the utter garbage. This was a response to genocide. That these investment groups that, you know, claim to be bishops, I mean, some of them weren't even clergy. Or they'd stick, you know, their cousin on there or something. Not only did they have no knowledge of the tradition, but they were threatened by it. Destroying libraries was something that the Muslims did, certainly with Jewish assistance, because a historical understanding is the threat. An ethnic group is nothing without its history. It is a history. So ethno-nationalism became of immense significance because of the destruction that was wreaked by this horrible Fanar rule over the Balkans. And this hasn't been stressed enough. There is no canonical order other than the exarchate at the time in most of the Balkans. We need to be very clear here. So you still have the mentality in Serbia that they are still rebuilding. They're rebuilding the Serbian nationalist understanding, which comes from their own sources. Of course, Byzantine sources prior to the Turks. But these historical sources and the Slavic tradition was actively suppressed. You have the Patriarch of Constantinople saying there is no such thing as a Slavic language. There is no such thing. I mentioned it in this. I can't remember who it was. I mentioned it on this show on philotism, where he said there is no such thing as Bulgarian. This is clearly a threat. But it was a threat only because if people understood their tradition, they would then have a foundation to rebel from. And that foundation would be a Christian one. Not a secular, Judaic one. We all know what happened in Croatia under the NDH, where Serbs were slaughtered en masse. And they were slaughtered, men, women, you know, children, or at least driven out, without the support of the German government. And this has to be made clear. The German High Command condemned the NDH. This was purely an Italian and Roman movement, the most extreme of that faction of the Franciscans that was part of the NDH movement. This wasn't, I mean, the nationalist ideology was okay. But then how it manifests itself is absurd. And what then happened is that Nedic had to deal with refugees coming in from Croatia. Throughout, what probably his biggest problem, other than having to deal with the German occupation, is the fact that he has about 1 million refugees that he has to feed and settle, with no support from the British, of course, or anybody else for that matter, within the borders of his state. But you have about roughly, most of them are from the west, but you have also those from fleeing the Hungarians in the north as well. He created the Institute for Communist Youth. The Institute, it's like an asylum. This was a way that he was able to convert the youth, these Antifa people of his day, to civilization. Chances are they'd just be killed by, you know, the NDH or Chetnik or Stur German. But by, you know, creating an educational system that they could then be a part of, sort of a remedial education, re-education, they might be able to make civilized people out of them. And there's certainly nothing wrong with that. In his mind, not only was he fighting Marxism, but he was also saving these kids. So those were two of the more significant and specific achievements of his brief rule of 3 years. In South Korea, you had a very similar institute, which I'm actually writing on right now, where, you know, this was re-education. If you've been brainwashed by these people into believing the absurd ideas of materialism, and this is for whatever reason how you're raised, and that you think that you are the voice of history, and that you need to kill as many people as possible in order to bring this about, you're a criminal. And, you know, there's something wrong with you. It might not be your fault, but there's something wrong with you. Rather than simply shoot them, they created institutes where they could finally learn what the truth of the matter is. All opinions aren't equal. People don't have a right to whatever opinion they have. Most of the time, you know, opinions are based on nothing even close to knowledge. Who knows why they reach? And, you know, during wartime, life is cheap. Morality is in the gutter. The rule of the strongest. And the image that Nedich always brought out was the mother. Today, the female is the bearer of destruction and leftism from the regime, which has recreated the family. But through most of civilized history, almost all of it, the woman was the foundation of conservatism. How does a society hold together under foreign occupation, where all other institutions have fallen apart? Think of, you know, Afghanistan in the last 50 years. Germany after World War I. Motherhood. The heart of the family, the essence of the family. War destroys morality. Love of the mother supports it. The love of the mother such that they'll die for the betterment of their children. And they'll do anything for them. But their own self-interest is meaningless. This is the motherhood that then, of course, he uses as a metaphor for his own rule, for political rule in general. And something Nicholas II in Russia also did previously. But motherhood was a huge image for him as everything was falling apart around him. Serbia was in flames, on the verge of being divided up. It was divided up. Remember, the Bulgarian troops were used in the occupation. What can he hold on to? Motherhood, both in terms of the mother of God as well as an actual biological mother. The matriarchs of the Zadruga clan centers. The nation as mother, of course, being fertile. And really the idea of political rule more generally. This is what holds it together. Now, specifically in the Serbian case, it is Saint Sava and Saint Stepanemanja. I mean, Sava being a member of that family, of course. This is the image. The desire, and, you know, ethnic nationalism has existed as long as humanity has, and Sava and Stepan are a proof of it. They speak of the Serbian nation. And they differentiate it from the Greeks and the Vlachs and others, and certainly the Jews. So you have motherhood and fatherhood on a macro scale as well as a micro scale. One of his most memorable speeches concerning was, you know, what holds everything together when everything is falling apart? Now, we don't have that today. Woman has been perverted to the point where I can't even talk about it without getting upset. Woman has been perverted beyond reason into something that she was never meant to be. She's not a nurturer. She's miserable. Transsexualized, God knows what kind of medicated freak. But Netted still lived at a time where it was the female matriarch that held everything together when the government failed. When everything failed. So, you have a state here. You have a man, General Nandich, who is essentially dragged into power, does not want it, as his country is in flames. He was no collaborator with the Germans. I mean, it had nothing to do with Hitler. Just they were a foreign power that shouldn't be there. It's unfortunate. But this is the fault of the British, not the Germans. The Germans were fighting a good fight. They were trying to destroy the Soviet Union. The British, of course, were allied with them. They had too many investments there, as did the French and the Americans. Oh, and as an aside, at the end of the war, Nedich was arrested. And he had surrendered to the British. Thinking, and this happened actually quite often, thinking that that would be a lot better than being arrested by Stalin's people or Tito. And as always, they turned the anti-communists over to Tito's forces. This was common, not just Operation Keelhaul, but you know, this is how they did it. The anti-communist nationalists were seen as the enemy. This was the enemy. That was the case 100 years ago. That's the case today. That's the case then. Remember something. Capitalism has always been international. There was never a national period of capitalism. Why do I say that? I should say modern European version of it, because industrialization requires massive inputs that are not available domestically. Only a very large colonial empire can create that. You know, silver coming in from Latin America, the slave economy, overseas trade, overseas exploitation. That's what came and built the industrial, very unnatural industrial world. Hence, it's by definition international. It's by definition based on the state, or really the empire. Capitalism and the state are two sides of the same coin, of course. The libertarians don't know what they're talking about. There is no capitalism without the state. I mean, everything is created by the climate that's created by the empire. But the inputs that you would need, and the markets that you would need for industrialization, for modern capitalism, can only come from colonialism. And therefore, it is inherently a cosmopolitan ideology. There was never a time when it was anything else. Something, a big area that Marxism and capitalism have in common. He wants to rebuild the medieval Serbian idea in the 1940s. To take, at least get something good, some silver lining out of the misery that he sees around him. To rebuild labor organization and profit sharing. Social security, health insurance, cheap credit, forgiveness of debt. Labor as an ethical entity, not just something that you have to do. He had a national service program. Young men drafted to go off and work into the fields where they needed it. He imitated German models and all of these things. Because if you want to rebuild a country that is in flames, whose morale and whose morality had collapsed, that's what you have to do. The state has to be strong. You have to dig deep, not into some foreign ideology, but into your own people. That Germany and Serbia, in his mind, were actually natural allies. And maybe one day Russia will be free again, you know, thinking in his mind in the 1940s. It was very, very clear that the Anglo-Soviet alliance was solid. It had a long history. And that the only enemy was nationalism. He tried to create as much of a normal world as he possibly could as Serbia went up in flames. Again, this is no fault of the Germans. This is a fault of the British, who overthrew the pro-Axis monarchy. Knowing this was going to happen, knowing that Serbs are going to be killed, they continued to insist on warfare, even though they knew that 50 Serbs would be killed for every wounded German. That didn't bother them. Their immediate interests were far more important. So you really have an extraordinary example and a great man. He has been canonized by a group over there. I've seen the icon, which is very nice. He was murdered. The window that he allegedly threw himself out of couldn't be opened. So there was obviously something more to it. There was also no blood splatter or anything like that where he was found. So obviously, you know, he was on the verge of really exposing the Anglo-Soviet alliance in his trial. The last thing he wanted to do was kill himself. But he was a Serbian nationalist. And it's something that I love and I truly respect. Anyway, I ask you for your financial contributions as I continue my work here. I desperately need it. I didn't have any time to get into details, but it's important. And for my supporters, I thank you. And I'm sending copies of my incomplete but worthwhile works for you to take a look at in exchange for your donation. Thank you very much. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.